Colonel Upjohn, Reel 2. Could you tell me about the servants you had in El Obeid, sir?
Yes, ma'am. Well, we, I think, were different to the other people there because we employed civilian servants. And we were responsible for employing them. They could not talk any English, so it was absolutely essential we talk Arabic. And we took them to war with us, and God knows what would have happened if any of them had been injured, but then, as far as I know, none of them were. But according to your status, when I was in Bashi, I had a servant who was a grand little chap called Hassan Adam, and I had him the head of my service. And he was a wonderful chap. And he had a sort of young boy who did sort of was a large part of the washing and that sort of thing, and washing of clothing and so forth, and helping to sort of bring things in from the kitchen. Then there was the cook. And the cook had his boy, because he had to have his boy, because that was one of the things that he had to have. And then there was the syce. If you had two horses, then he had another boy to do that. And they were paid practically nothing. And they ate, I suppose, free. But I was very fond of them, and they were great friends, and Hassan Adam and I became the greatest friends. Yeah. He became a great friend to us all, but at the same time, they were in some ways stupid. He was a Nuba, actually, and black. And for instance, if you had a drink, you had a gin and bitters, like I had today, for instance. And that was gin mar bitters. But one friend of mine wanted gin and water. So we said, gin mar moya, which is gin and water. And they couldn't understand that. But eventually, they decided that it was better. And they did understand gin mar bitters, bedoon bitters, which is gin and bitters without bitters. And they understood that. And there was another time I remember when we were in the... he was a very brave little man, and we were carrying at Kufra in the trenches when we were being bombed by the Italians. And we were really being bombed because the LRDG and the SAS had done brilliantly and done them home. And we were suffering. We were in the trenches. And Hassan and I was cowering in a trench. And Hassan walked along and took my steel helmet, threw it down, put it on top of my head and said, "You know you're supposed to wear that." Walked away. Shells, bombs dropping all around him. There was another occasion when Rhino Fosdick was before the war, and Rhino was a great polo player, but there was one new vet who arrived, and he was very, very special. He looked beautiful on a horse, had wonderful clothes, but the one thing that he didn't do was he didn't hit it very hard. And Rhino occasionally used to explode, and suddenly from the other end of the ground he shouted, "Don't dribble the ball, hit up,
etc.
etc." Well, we were all at my house that night, and Guy Campbell was there. We were stayed up a bit late having a drink or two, and Hassan was a born mimic. And Guy Campbell took Hassan aside. It was getting dark, and that's when we had our lights on. And Rhino was our commanding officer at that time, and suddenly, from the bushes, miles away, came the voice, "Don't dribble the ball, hit that," etc. Absolutely in Rhino's voice. Rhino wasn't quite certain whether he'd heard a ghost or whether he'd had too much drink or what. His glass fell out of his hand. And at that moment, Guy and Hassan Adam appeared both giggling. But I mean, that was the sort of thing that went on. And, I mean, it didn't make any difference somehow to discipline. I mean, they had a great sense of humour, and next moment we were giving orders and they were.
It helped, I suppose, that they were civilians and not actually part of the army ranking.
I think so, but it was very worrying during the war because we never quite knew what was going to happen if they were, because they were with us absolutely in it all.
They volunteered to come, I imagine. Or wasn't it as direct as that?
We took it for granted they would come, and they did come, but I presume they volunteered, that was it. There wasn't much for them to do in Elabed once we'd gone and everybody else really, so they came along.
Did you learn much about their families?
Not a thing. I hadn't got a clue.
Do you think they would have volunteered the information if you had asked?
Quite honestly, it never entered my head.
Did you have a holiday for them, or leave periods for them to go home?
Well, they largely went off on holidays and that sort of thing when we took leave. And as I didn't have any leave much, but I did have two local leaves, Hess and Adam went off then on holiday, and occasionally, I mean, we let him off occasionally and that sort of thing.
Where did he live when he was staying with you?
Oh, they had some tuckles in the ground that they occupied and so on.
Was there a turnover in servants, would you say, in general? Quite a high turnover? Or did people tend to keep their servants once they'd been?
I think on the whole people tended to keep them. I mean, I know that Bruno had one that he kept the whole time. I kept one the whole time. I think as a general rule, one servant, what mine called Bethlehem, one kept. Occasionally one got rid of one's cook. The cook's rather tended to drink more than the others, and if he got tight too often, eventually we had to sack it. But there it was. But no, we were very fond of them all.
Was it true that, as I've heard said, the cooks could produce enormous dinner parties at the drop of a hat?
Yes.
How did they do this, do you know?
One never knew, but I mean, it was absolutely true that they could. I mean, the thing was that it was supposed not to be the thing to do to drink after dinner. But I hadn't known one have dinner at 12 o'clock at night and expect that dinner quite well to come up, and it did. I mean, always just the same. And furthermore, they were brilliant at producing a hot meal on trek, quite often without having opening a single tin. How they did it, I don't know, but they were very good at it.
What did you pay them?
The answer is I can't remember. But all I can tell you is my pay at that time was £60 a month. And I paid them the average wage, which we knew to be the average wage. And I ate and drank as much as I wanted to. And I still saved £30 a month. So I couldn't have paid them all that amount. Do you see what I mean? But it was like that. I mean, they were all quite satisfied because there was a sort of more or less a rate. And I think actually that there was a sort of snob element went into it, and somebody in the Camel Corps was expected to pay slightly more perhaps than the PWB. But on the other hand, the PWB, they didn't have quite as many because they weren't paid quite as much. They had to work a good deal harder. So it worked both ways, but it was all very happy on that.
What did your servants wear?
Oh, I can show you. They wore a white they wore sort of ordinary brown, ordinary kit during the day, but in the evenings and sort of lunch and that sort of thing, they wore white, I forget what they're called, not jibbers, but long things, and a white
skull cap?
Turban things, and then a green thing down there, and they were allowed to wear the SDF thing going down
on
there.
On their forehead?
On their thing, which they were very thrilled to do. I can show you a photograph of it.
What sort of food did you eat?
Well, we had eggs and everything like that for breakfast. In peacetime, if you were rich, you had odd hampers sent from Fortnum and Mason.
Did you?
No, occasionally, but very simple. But there was a very good shop in Khartoum, which sent us wonderful things. And there was also a very good shop in El Obeid. But we ate the normal things that we want to eat, but sometimes, I mean, the meats weren't awfully good, but they were what you would get. The sort of things that were surprising were that delicacies were, so I remember the occasionally aircraft used to come down from Khartoum to El Obeid, and they used to come, some people used to come down early in the morning, and the great delicacy was when they brought us fresh kippers. That was the sort of thing. But normally one would eat fairly well the same thing. And I told you about this full Sudanese soup that they
Did you like that?
I loved that, yes.
Did you ever get the recipe?
No, never. And I don't think anybody has. And I've had it produced, seen, shown it in tin, so it's not the same. But of course, there's creme caramel they could produce very well, otherwise they weren't very good at puddings. But on the whole, we ate quite well. I can't remember what bread we ate. I suppose they produced bread.
Was it English-style food, or did it have any other sort of national flavouring to it?
On the whole, English side food, I think.
Did you have any curries?
Yes, lots. Largely, the boys usually had the Friday off because it was the Mohammedan holiday, and they cooked it the day before, and it was then produced to us on Friday. And we had the day off, and we used to eat rather late on a Friday, but curry was easily produced at any time for lunch, and we often had curry on time. It was very good too.
Did you ever inspect the kitchen?
No, because it was safer not to, otherwise one would be put off one's food, but at the same time one's wives did, and one had bachelor cooks and married officers cooks, and they didn't blend. I mean, you had one or the other. And I think that if a chap got married, very often he had to change his cook because he didn't like to work. I remember my wife when she was out there, I think she only went into the kitchen once and decided never to go again because she was so horrified. But as far as I know, nobody had any illness from sort of bad food or anything like that. But it was, if you went in there, you would have been absolutely horrified. But I'm sure you would.
When you say there was a bachelor cook and a married man's cook, would a boy or a cook advertise himself as a particular kind of servant? Or would you just automatically change your servants once you got married?
I think actually that they would form up and say, I'm not sure whether I want to work for your wife. I have nothing against your wife, but I prefer to work for bachelors and vice versa, you see. And I don't really know, there was no advertising, but it was sort of, it was the Bush Telegraph, and Upshaw's wanting so and so and so and so and so. It would be a stream of people would arrive next day saying, I hear you want a job.
What were the rules concerning married officers? At what age would one be allowed to marry in the SDF?
You mean British officers? As far as I know, you went out there, you had to go out there and you were single. If you wanted to get married, if the Kaid wanted you, then, and there was a vacancy for you, then you served in the as a staff officer in headquarters troops Sudan. Otherwise you had to go home if you wanted to get married. But when I was there in 1951-52, there were one or two people who for instance, I was married and I was allowed to command the Camel Corps as a married officer. And that was the only reason really why, not the only reason, but I mean I wouldn't have gone otherwise. Because it meant a nice sort of, you know, break away from everything. And also, furthermore, my children had come out free, which was a great experience for them. They came out for the holidays. And it worked out very well because we had a home in Leicestershire, and they would all come out for the Christmas holidays, which was paid free. And then my wife would go back for the Easter holidays and for the summer holidays, and I would go back for my 3 months leave, which I was supposed to get, but I did get actually in 1952-53, and for my 3 months leave at that time it worked very well. Then she would come out again in about, well, when the children had gone back to school in September. It worked really very well. But of course it was different in 52, 53, 54, and that sort of time that it was before the war, because there were far more married people around then.
We'll come on to the 50s later. Could I just ask you perhaps in more detail about alcohol consumption in the SDF? You said a little earlier that people tended to cut down once they got to the Sudan if they'd been drinkers before. What was the sort of pattern of drinking? The sort of codes attached to it?
Well, I think actually that when you'd been out on trek and that sort of thing, or when you've been in your office all day, you come back and have a bottle of beer or something like that. Then you perhaps have a couple of pink gins, and then you'd lie down and you'd go and sit it all out playing polo or squash. And in the evening, one largely drank whiskey and had a gin beforehand, but you never drank after dinner. During the war, I hardly drank at all because I was too frightened to, you know, blot in the copybook and that sort of thing. There were people who, there was no doubt about it, that the SDF drank considerably more than the political did, and we had more uproarious parties which went on far longer than the others did, and we were considered rather, I don't say vicious and licentious, and we weren't licentious, but more vicious, but you know, they were, which I don't think we were. But there were one or two who, if it got hold of you out there, you got onto it pretty well. And I could well see that happening. But we were all a bit careful. And it didn't go too far. But it was a problem, because if you were sitting on your own, it was so easy to just sort of, you know, like that. But I think on the whole, very few. I can name one or two who did. But, I mean,
I'm sure you won't.
Including myself.
Did you have much time for reading when you were at El Obeid in peacetime? Novels from home or newspapers?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I read more then than at any other time, because I was all alone and that sort of thing. We had a wireless which we could have, and luckily, being in El Obeid, which is the end of the railway line, I used to actually have the Times sent out to me there. Why, I don't know, but I did have the Times in certain local papers, and I read them fairly carefully.
You still retained a great interest in what was happening in England?
Oh, yes, very much so. Very much so indeed. Of course, we greatly look forward to, of course, all our mail which came out, and even more so during the war. I remember when I was at Kufra, one of the things which I used to get so angry with the people at Wadi Halfa was that they didn't put the mail on the aircraft, which came up once a week. Gave them hell for that sort of thing, because it was so, you know, lack of thought. But, yes, we had kept a very, very close touch.
How regular was the mail at El Obeid?
I can't quite remember, but I think three times a week, twice or three times a week. And once a week when we were in Kufra, provided it came up on the aircraft. Otherwise it came on the convoy, which took 7 days.
And could you describe the medical service which served the SDF?
They were wonderful. We had a grand little man called Henry Richards, who had been a doctor in the Sudan political service. And he commanded a unit called 1MFH, which is the Mobile Field Hospital. And I think that he had, I think, a Sudanese doctor. How far he was trained, I don't know. And I suppose about 6 or 7 medical orderlies, which he trained himself. And I think a couple of ambulances. But that was all.
And their patch was Kordofan, was it?
What?
Where was their patch?
Oh, that was during the war. In peacetime, we dealt, as far as I know, I never got involved in that, because the Sudanese officers dealt with the health of those sorts of people and that sort of thing. And we must remember that we were called an irregular force, and the medical side, provided they were past fit, and one of the Sudan Medical Service examined them. We didn't worry very much, and if they were unfit or was ill, that sort of thing. The Sudan officers, Sudanese officers, dealt with that. We didn't deal with that much. At least I didn't. I may have been wrong, maybe in peculiar. The British, we dealt with the British people out there.
A medical officer?
Yes. But of course, during the war, we had our MFH, which came along with us, and they were jolly good.
What provision was made for dental care and haircuts and those sort of things?
Terrible. None.
Did you cut each other's hair? Or was there a local barber that people attended?
Talking to one who's never had his hair as long as it now before. As far as I know, I can't remember, but I think there must have been a Sudanese who did it, but I don't know. I can't remember. But I know he kept it short in those days.
And there was no provision that you can remember for dental care?
No.
Do you think, looking back, there should have been more medical provision for you? Or was it adequate? I'm talking about peacetime.
It never entered my head that it wasn't adequate. I think it was that we were just lucky. And I think, quite likely, if there was any real trouble, they had to be flown to Khartoum. I can't remember a dentist in El Abeid.
Were you ever ill yourself?
Hardly at all, except that I had,
malaria?
Yeah. And I repeated it once or twice after that. It wasn't bad. But otherwise, I wasn't. But other people, I mean, they had... heat thing which struck your body. I can't remember what it's called, but a lot of people got that, but it didn't affect me. Prickly heat. And the extraordinary thing, too, was that everybody was supposed to get sunstroke. They were worried last week, didn't wear any sort of special headgear or so on.
Did you wear sunglasses?
I never did, but a lot of people did, and of course, they perpetually wore them. And I decided that I wouldn't. Why, I don't know, but I didn't, but a lot of people wear them. We used to wear them even in their house.
So you adjusted to the climate and the terrain quite easily, did you?
I was lucky. I think... I don't want to boast, but I think I was comparatively fit when I went out there. The thing really was, it was a dry heat, and it hit some people's nerves. I was lucky it didn't hit mine, but it did hit some people's nerves, and that was sometimes worrying, and they would,
What happened to them?
They would become irritable and nervy and so on.
Would they be removed, or would they carry on?
I think that with regard to us in the SDF, they were probably there, if it was in peacetime, their contract wouldn't be renewed if they become... I don't know about the others.
Could you describe the layout of the camp at El Obeid and its relation to the town?
Well, the town was on one side of the Maidan, and that had all the shops and the market. Then there was what they call the Maidan, which was a sort of expanse of about 400 or 500 yards. And then there was a sort of British element, where we had all our bungalows. And then there was what they call the Moudaria, which was where the governor had us, and literally only 200 yards away was our headquarters. In our headquarters, all our sort of offices and stores and buildings and garages, they were behind barbed wire. So if anything really happened, we could get into this barbed wire entanglement. It never happened in my time, but there were times when it did. And it happened far more, actually, in company stations outside when there was trouble, largely in the Newmar Mountains. There was occasionally trouble there. In my time there was no trouble. not that it was anything to do with me, it was just that they were more interested in sort of getting on with the war, which they all thought was coming.
How exactly were the Africans accommodated?
Sudanese. They had their own they had their own quarters. Those were married quarters. Where they were single ones, I can't remember where they did, but they were always available on parade, and I suppose they slept somewhere. I think they had a sort of barrack room they slept in. But the others had their own tukuls.
How big were these tukuls? Would you give an estimate of the size?
About two-thirds of the size of this room. Mm-hmm.
And about...
Round in size. I can show you one.
About 15 by 12.
About two-thirds the size of this
room. And what were they made of?
Oh, sort of... clay sort of stuff. They were made every year, and in the wet weather, they were quite often, when the rains came, they obviously quite often disintegrated, and they had straw roofs, and they had to be rebuilt, you know, again before the next time. And that was entirely the responsibility of the Sudanese officers. They were actually, in my time, called native officers, but now they're called Sudanese officers.
What sort of food or rations did the Sudanese other ranks have?
Quite honestly, I don't really know. I know the ration that they had, which I can show you. But there again, they were responsible for feeding themselves. And I never really got involved in that. I don't really know. I can visualize what it was, but I can't really know. It looked a most awful, peculiar mess to me. But there it was, they were quite happy. And they drank lots of this Marisa beer. And they had a sort of peculiar sort of dried meat, which they ate, which they enjoyed too.
Sort of biltong?
Yes, that sort of thing, but it wasn't. It was another name. And of course, when we went out on track, if you were a good shot, shoot those lovely little creatures and odd birds, and they were very popular.
Now, what was the army's line on consumption of alcohol by the Sudanese other ranks?
I think largely the same as it was with the British army. I mean, provided they did their job, it was no affair of ours, but if they caused trouble, it was more of a trouble. There were obviously some soldiers who caused trouble, but there were also some Sudanese officers who were a great problem with regard to that too, because they were. It was a problem. It was a problem for us all.
You never tried to stamp it out?
The answer is that it never struck us that would happen, just as it never struck us in the British Army that it would happen. But, I mean, a commanding officer would say, as I've heard some people say, in a British unit, you're all, especially in an officer's mess, you're all drinking too much and that sort of thing. Well, then, and your mess bills are too high for this sort of thing. In a way, I suppose it'd be the same in Sudan. But you see, Sudanese officer, he lived on his own. He didn't live in a mess or anything like that. And providing it didn't impair with his efficiency, it was no business of ours.
What sort of social contact did you have with the Sudanese officers?
Socially, just about nil. I mean, my wife was saying she never met any of the wives at all. And we really didn't have very much. In 1952, 53, 54, when I was there, we had more. But we found that they kept their wives. It was rather like when the Queen went out there. I mean, it was the first woman who was ever sort of seen there. And we, I mean, we didn't interfere with the wives at all, or anything connected with the sort of marriage side. We were, a regular force, and responsible really for their salary, and not for their feeding, and not for their sort of social life very much. And that, in a way, for us officers, British officers, in a way was a godsend, in a way. But we left that entirely to the Sudanese officers, and they had their problems, especially when we all went up at the beginning of the war and we were all sent up to Atbara, which is quite a long way away, and I can't remember how long it was before they went allowed back on leave, but they didn't seem to complain. But it was the Sudanese officers who dealt with that. We didn't, unless there was any sort of frightful problem. But I mean, it was their responsibility, and they dealt with it.
Although you didn't have a responsibility for their wives and their general well-being outside the purely military side, did you take a personal interest in any of the officers? Are there any individuals whom you would remember from this peacetime period?
Talking about looking after the wives and that sort of thing, looking back at that, we were worried about them being left in war for so long, because they never were. And that was a great worry to us, and we inquired about that, how they were getting on from time to time. We used to get reports up on that, and we were worried about that, because naturally the morale of the soldiers depended, as it does in the British Army, very much on your family. And as most of them couldn't write, it was a great worry to us as to how they were getting information backwards and forwards about it. But it seemed to work all right, but how it did, I don't know.
You didn't form any personal friendships with any of the Sudanese officers?
Oh, yes, I did. I was very fond of them. I mean, I was especially fond I was the British staff officer, and I had Abdullah Bey Halil, who was actually senior to me, Al-Kaimakam Abdullah Bey Halil.